Hello, everybody, and welcome to this very special episode of Take One. Today, I am here with Andrew Bujalski. He is a director that I very much admire and respect. This is absolutely incredible. I can't believe I'm doing this interview right now. Andrew Bujalski is someone who I very much respect because he wears many different hats when it comes to filmmaking. Andrew Bujalski is a director, a writer, an actor, an editor, and a lot more. He has been called the godfather of mumblecore, and you might know him as the mind behind movies such as Funny Haha, Mutual Appreciation, Beeswax, Computer Chess, Results, Support the Girls, and most recently, They're There, which is currently screening at this year's Vancouver International Film Festival. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Hell yes. Okay, you know, as I said, your most recent film is They're There. This is a film that I found absolutely fascinating. I was just telling you before we started the interview that, you know, I watched it, then, you know, reading all the behind-the-scenes stuff and all the production information about the film, I was just absolutely blown away. I could talk about this film because I very much enjoyed it, but, you know, I thought we would let you do the talking. So that brings me to my first question, which is, can you tell us a bit about They're There? What is this film and what makes it so special?
Oh, well, it's an awfully strange movie for sure. All the marketing people say never use the word experimental, but it's kind of experimental. We made a movie that's about, it's about faith, that it's about trust. But we shot it with all the performances in isolation. So we shot one performer at a time, and it's mostly a series of conversations that are interlinked, and you know, some themes and story grow out of that. But you see people speaking to each other, and they're not, in fact, in the same room. They're stitched together through the magic of movie editing, which is what editing always is, right? It's always kind of a trick. So we just pushed that trick as far as we could, and made a movie where you're seeing people in dialogue with each other who, in fact, were 1,000 miles apart and weeks apart from each other. So it's, in some ways, it's an experiment in movie making, but also I think a story about people trying to reach across distances to each other. It's hard to explain.
No, you nailed it.
Okay.
Great explanation. Love the film. And yes, as you guys heard Andrew say, you know, no two characters were at the same time on the same location. And that was the little fact that blew my mind after watching the film. And that brings me to my next question, which is, you know, of course, you made this film during the pandemic. And my next question is, what were the biggest challenges of making a movie in this time?
Well, you know, I think obviously in March of 2020, when lockdown hit the world, you know, conventional movie making for a little while there became impossible, and then people started to find their way back, and most of the finding their way back became about building bubbles, and I think for the Hollywood model, I think for Hollywood surprisingly little changed. You know, I don't know. I wasn't on those huge productions, but my sense is that those productions are kind of always bubbles anyway. So they just said, well, we just need a thicker bubble, and we just need to throw another $30 million at this, and we're fine. And to me, part of what I've always loved about indie filmmaking, the kind of filmmaking that I've done, is that, you know, whether because you can't afford it or because you don't want it, there's a lot less bubble. There's a lot more intimacy to the nature of a smaller, cheaper movie. But that also made it trickier for what would, you know, to add that bubble, I think, changed things a lot for indie filmmakers. And what this perverse part of me, and you have to be perverse to make indie movies, thought, well, let's, what happens if I take this idea and just of locking down and of, you know, creating barriers, and what if I just push that all the way and I do something that I'm pretty sure nobody else is going to do, and really, really isolate people? To me, that started to get at something that I thought was interesting about because, as saying a moment ago, you know, there's always, every time I cut from you to me, there's a bit of a trick and a fakery to that. Yeah. So I thought, let's extend that all the way and have people really not be anywhere near each other, and we put it all together. And so what you see on screen is kind of people imagining each other's performance. And that, to me, there was a real magic in that, and something I was excited about. As for challenges, I mean, this was an absurdly challenging way to make a movie because we were nowhere near each other. So I've got performers all over the U.S. and you know, we shot in Italy and we shot in Germany, and I never left my desk. So I was on Zoom the entire time. My cinematographer was on Zoom. The producers were on Zoom. Art director. We on the ground with the actor. We'd have a kind of micro crew. Some, you know, between 2 and 4 people, essentially, like what you guys have here.
Fair enough.
And that was it. They were there. We weren't there. So, as I say, the movie's about trust and faith. The production was also about trust and faith, because we were trying to find each other across great distances. Yeah.
That's very meta and really, really fascinating. Yeah, I love the fact that, you know, you made this beautiful, beautiful film about human connections, and yet, you know, everything is shot in isolation. Everything is shot without those, you know, physical, direct human connections. I think you nailed it. Like, you know, the paradoxical nature of this film, it's something that really, really impacted me. Mm. Okay, now I guess that brings me to my third question, which is, you know, I was very touched by this film. I was very moved, and, you know, there are many things that I was thinking after watching it. But my question is, what would you like viewers to take away from watching this movie?
Oh, man. I mean, that's really up to viewers, you know.
Great answer.
Well, it's a funny thing. I think I've been thinking about this a lot, because movie making is so collaborative at every stage. And so always part of the joy and part of what's scary about it is that you're inviting, you know, certainly with the actors and the other and technicians and people who are contributing in any number of ways, you're inviting other people into something and trying to make something with them. And I've realized, I think the audience is kind of the final collaborator. Mm. And of course the least predictable one. So, you know, there are always going to be people who aren't interested or who don't like it or whatever. But for everyone who does engage with it and finds something in it, you know, you hope that they'll find something unique to their own life, to their own experience. I can't prescribe that. I think that's, you know, at a certain point, I present it to you, and then you have to make something with it.
Hell yes, perfect answer. I love that idea of the audience as the final collaborator. That is something that I'm definitely quoting from you from here on out.
Well, I've been thinking of it in terms. I think a lot of people, certainly in this day and age, you know, there's this idea that like that the audience is the boss. And I realize that's never quite sat well with me. It's not the idea of fan service. Well, I don't want to just say, tell me what to do and then do it. That doesn't feel quite right. By the same token, I also don't want to say, I made this fucking thing, sit down, shut up, you know, you take what I want from it. It's not about that either. It has to be a conversation and some investment from both of us for it to work, I think.
Hell yeah. And there's something to be said about movies that, you know, require a bit more from your audiences, you know, that requires audiences to meet them halfway, I guess. Mm-hmm. Those are the films that I, you know, really enjoy and that really sit with me afterwards. So, hey, congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, you know, as I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, you are referred to as the godfather of mumblecore. Huge title. And that brings me to my next question, which is, you know, in your opinion, from your personal experience, what is mumblecore? Can you define this term? And also, how do you feel about the fact that you are called the godfather of mumblecore?
You know, it'll be on my tombstone, so it doesn't really matter how I feel about it. That's fine. I'm fine with that. The word, it's interesting because I've kind of learned it. I mean, it's had such currency, and it's extraordinary to me that this was a joke that my sound mixer, Eric Masanaga, who I've been working with for 20 years,
oh, wow.
And who worked on this movie, he said that word to me as a joke. I made the grievous error of repeating it to a journalist. But now it's like a global concept, and which is amazing to me. It's bigger than any movie I've ever made, certainly, in terms of its impact. So that's just been interesting to see. And so I've kind of learned, you know, from context, you see the word come up here and there, and you start to get a sense of what people mean by it. But I don't know. I mean, it has nothing to do with my creative process. I think the best part of it to me maybe defines a kind of spirit of collaboration, and maybe a generation of filmmakers or a group of us, certainly not the whole generation, but a small subset of folks who maybe had some similar ideas about approach at a similar time. It doesn't mean that much ultimately, deeply. Certainly, I think for my own movie, or for my own work, I never felt like I was inventing anything new. I was only kind of taking old things that inspired me in all kinds of cinema, and maybe recontextualizing them just because time had passed and things had changed. But yeah, I don't know what mumblecore means.
Hey, great answer. You heard it right here, right now. but yeah, no, I will say that there is something so human, so unpredictable, like, yeah, so beautifully unpredictable in all of your films, that even though I don't also know what mumblecore is, I think I sort of get the sense of what people are saying when they call you the godfather of mumblecore. But yeah, okay. Also, at the beginning of this interview, I also mentioned that you do wear many different hats when it comes to filmmaking. You direct, you write, you edit, you act, you do so, so much. As someone who's an aspiring filmmaker, when I saw that, I was like, whoa, this is very overwhelming. And that brings me to my next question, which is, you know, even though you tend to write and direct your films, you also edit them. And, you know, editing is something that I struggle a lot with my own things, because I'm like, hey, I directed this, so I'm like personally attached to this. and that brings me to my question, which is, you know, what are some of the advantages and challenges that you find in editing the same footage that you shot and wrote?
I love editing, and I hadn't done it in a bit. So I did edit this latest movie, and the two before that I'd worked with other editors, and that was a great experience. Yeah. It's quite nice to work. I'm very slow. I mean, even just technically, like, I don't, you know, I still haven't learned most of the Avid shortcuts and things, so it takes me forever. So it was great to work with people who were really good and really knew what they're doing, but also creatively, just we're going to bring an aspect and bring ideas that I always, it's nice to have, if you like someone and trust them, it's thrilling to have another voice in the room. So I loved working with Robin Schwartz on Results and Karen Skloss on Support the Girls. But I knew on this project, I knew that we were doing something very, you know, we didn't have a lot of money, and so it was, you know, it was just as well that I do it for free. but also, because this particular project was so strange, and I'd never made anything like it, none of us had, we didn't really know what the language was. I kind of felt like the only way for me to find this language is just to get in there and do it myself. There's no way for me to delegate or to talk about this to someone else, because I don't know. I don't know how this movie is supposed to stick together, and all I can do is just, and we had a ton of footage too. I think we had about 80 hours of footage on this, which is,
oh wow,
I'm pretty sure the most I've ever had, by a fair bit. So Jesus. Yeah, so I thought if the only way I could figure to do it was I just need to wade through this 80 hours of footage myself, and I need to try everything myself, and I, you know, because I'm not, I don't know how to talk about it otherwise. So, you know, it's a slog for sure, but it's very exciting when you're getting something, and when it's working, when you make those connections, or when you improve something. I mean, that's the best feeling, when you have something that's okay and kind of works, and then you work it and work it and work it, and you go, wait, no, this is what it was missing. This is what was wrong. That's very exciting when you feel like the pieces start to fall into place and your movie starts to tell you what it is. Because in a way, editing is kind of the truest filmmaking. You know, everything before that is fishing. It's going out there and you think you have an idea and you're looking for it and you're trying things and you need to do all that. But the editing is where you really make the movie.
Yeah, they do say that you write the script three times, you know,
sure.
When you write it in the page, when you shoot it, and then when you edit it one last time.
Certainly.
So I guess you're writing the film three times.
At least.
That brings me to my next question, which is, apart from everything that I've already mentioned, and, you know, all the films that I've already listed as some of Andrew's movies, you also co-wrote the live-action remake for Disney's Lady and the Tramp. And I guess that brings me to my next question, which is, what was it like working with Disney? And also, what were some of the challenges that you faced when reimagining a classic tale as beloved as Lady and the Tramp?
Sure. Yeah. It's certainly daunting. You know, it was nice in a way to know that we weren't the first ones out there doing that. Disney had remade most everything else already, so there was a kind of template, and you know, people weren't going to kick our asses too much for destroying their classics that had already been done. I was so lucky to stumble into that job, and particularly, you know, of all the Disney movies, Lady and the Tramp was the one that felt most my language. It is unusual in that it's not really a fairy tale. It's very down to earth. In some ways, kind of a, you know, coming of age story, you know, a little bit of a romantic comedy story. It's all these things that I felt like I got and was excited to take on. You're not gonna top the original. You know, you're not really going to make something that feels like the original. It's a different language. But there were great opportunities in there, and it was fun to kind of dive into that story, move things around. It was an interesting process. It went fast.
Oh, wow. Because
they were motivated to get, they were just about to launch Disney Plus, and they wanted it for that. And so that was unique of my Hollywood experiences. Usually in Hollywood, you know, unless you're top priority for somebody, things go slow and you never know if anything's going anywhere. And this was to be on a kind of fast-tracked Hollywood project was quite interesting. But we went through a lot. I started thinking about ideas that went pretty far away from the original. Not in time. I mean, it was always a nice story about
yes.
two dogs. And but you know, we tried some ideas where it was set contemporary. And I'd come up with a lot of new things. And eventually we kind of, predictably enough, wound our way back to something that was pretty faithful to the original. But I found that process of going away and just trying to open it up in my mind was very, very helpful in bringing it back. Now, ultimately, you know, it's a big studio production. It goes through a lot. So it's a very different relationship than I have to my own movies where I am there at every stage of it. This was something where I kind of hand in my drafts and really enjoyed everybody I worked with, was always felt treated well and respected, but ultimately it's their show, it's a Disney project, and at a certain point they kind of say thank you, and then they go and do what they're going to do with it.
That's fair.
But it was fun to watch with my kids.
Hell yes. Yeah, it was also a lot of fun for me to watch, and you know, I really enjoyed some of the differences, some of the, you know, little new elements that you sprinkled into the film. Like, you know, I love the character development that you gave to the human characters specifically in this film. Like, I'm a huge fan of the original, but you know, in the original you barely even see the faces of the human characters.
Sure.
That was something that I very much enjoyed. Also, you know, the change in the setting. I'm not really sure where it's set, but it felt like this new live action remake felt very New Orleans, very...
Yeah, they shot in Savannah, yeah, which is a similar feel for sure.
Oh, yeah, fair enough. That brings me to my next question, which is one of my favorite animated films of recent years, or of all time, if I'm being honest, has to be I Lost My Body. I absolutely adore that movie. I remember watching it like 3 times, like in a week back in 2019. And you know, when I was looking through your IMDb page preparing for this interview, I was very pleasantly surprised to see that you were the creative lead for the English version of I Lost My Body. And my initial question was, what does that mean?
What is that? Yeah, yeah. They made that title up, but I was honored to have it. Also, I was asked by some folks at Netflix to take on that job of essentially, I think they initially asked me to direct the English dub, and it's something I'd never done before, but it was interesting and it was exciting. They got phenomenal actors in. They got Dev Patel and Alia Shawkat and George Wendt. I was excited about. And so I had a little bit to do with that casting. You know, they came to me and they said, who should we get for this? And I was like, well, you guys can afford these people. So you know, we kicked some of those names around, and that was fun to be a part of. But what ended up happening is that when I was told, they said, you know, Jeremy Clapin, the director, is in town and he's gonna stop by. And I thought, oh, this is intimidating. Like the director's gonna come see me ruining his movie. But in fact, Jeremy showed up, and it became pretty quickly clear that he wasn't just gonna hang around. He was gonna be there, and he essentially was directing the dub himself, which was great because it's his movie and he should. So I was there essentially, you know, they called it creative lead. I was there kind of as a, I don't know, as like the English language liaison, and I was by his side, and certainly his English is good, but, you know, I would occasionally weigh in on how something sounded or felt in English. So I was kind of a sub-director or something. But it was a great thing to be a part of. I mean, it's a beautiful movie, and yeah. I was so pleased to spend the time with it. As someone who, you know, took a few years of French in high school but doesn't remember much, it was fun to be in a room of French speakers all day, understanding like every fifth word of what they said.
I feel that. I also took 2 years of French in high school, and I don't remember anything except Je m'appelle Jean-Paul.
It's pretty good.
And J'adore les chocolats. Two things I need to know in French.
Fantastic.
But yeah, no, beautiful film. I really, really love it.
Thank you.
Now, I guess the penultimate question that I would like to ask is, what advice would you give to young filmmakers around the world?
What do you need? It's hard. I think you all know that.
Oh yeah.
You do it if you need to do it. Ultimately, I think you've got to be pretty stubborn to do it. So you would ignore my advice anyway, and that's for the best. The closest I ever get to advice, and it's not really advice. It's just selfish. You know, as a movie viewer, I always want to tell folks, it's so difficult. You have the rest of your life to be ground down by, you know, market demands and things. So I always encourage people not to run straight into that. You know, do what feels important to you for as long as you can get away with it. And I just say that because those are the movies I want to see. I want you guys to go make stuff that feels meaningful and important to you, and not so much about what's going to get me the next job. You know, those pressures are there whether or not you want them to be. So
that's amazing. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll definitely take this with me for the rest of my life.
You don't have to.
I will. Okay, and I guess that's it for this interview. Thank you all so much for watching, and thank you, Andrew, for accepting to doing this interview with all of us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Truly means a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, and that is it. Goodbye.